This morning, witness to a revolution. A president tells us he will see out his term, but the people tell him he's out of time. They want a nation reborn. Now,
President Hosni Mubarak has decided to step down as president.
It's just 18 days and he's gone. We can do everything.
Will democracy take hold in Egypt? What kind?
This is not the end of Egypt's transition. It's a beginning.
And what will it mean for the United States and the world? This week, America and the Revolution starts right now. Good morning, and this week the world has experienced a massive tectonic shift. People power peacefully overcoming 30 years of repressive rule. Egyptians put their stamp on their future. And today, the military has been pulling down tents on Tahrir Square, and ordinary citizens this weekend, armed with brooms and trash bags, literally swept out the old to usher in the new. Egypt's prime minister has said now the priority is to restore security. We'll try to navigate the fallout for the United States and the region. We have exclusive interviews with the former House Speaker Newt Gingrich and the Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak. It is still not clear what the future will look like there, but surely those 18 days in Egypt shook the world. It was an epic showdown between the people and an authoritarian regime they had chafed under for decades. But on Friday, the people won. Egypt won its freedom from a man who had ruled them for 30 years. In 18 days, they won the support of the rest of the world as the irresistible pictures of their struggle played out across the globe, on the internet and on television. And they won a victory for the revolutionary idea that democracy could now sweep across the Middle East. Word spread Friday morning that President Mubarak had left Cairo for his vacation home on the Red Sea, and my colleague Terry Moran was outside the presidential palace when the crowd there learned that he had also left the presidency.
The news hit this crowd like an enormous wave. In an instant, there was ecstasy.
Less than a week ago, President Mubarak had told me in this palace that he had resigned himself to leaving the presidency eventually, but said that he couldn't do it anytime soon for fear the country would descend into chaos. But by the end of this week, on Thursday, the biggest crowds yet had gathered on Tahrir Square, unsatisfied by the concessions the government had already granted. They demanded nothing less than President Mubarak's resignation. The tension inside the square ratcheted up as a rumor swirled that the army would launch a crackdown.
Believe me, we have 500,000 soldiers in our army that we love and respect. But if they turn on us, we'll turn on them.
But then the opposite happened. A promise, a pledge they had been waiting to hear from the lips of one of the country's highest-ranking military officials. Tonight, he told them, all your demands will be met. Everything you have said will come true. The crowd went wild, and they stayed that way all day and all night, waiting for Mubarak to tell them that he was leaving. Wael Ghanim, the young Google executive who was jailed for helping to organize the protests online, was overjoyed as he made his way into the square.
It's the dream come true, you know, the dream became true, and you know, whatever we have been fighting for since the 25th of January is now being realized, and it happened.
Back in the United States, President Obama also sounded confident that the end was near.
We are witnessing history unfold. It's a moment of transformation that's taking place because the people of Egypt are calling for change.
Testifying on Capitol Hill, the CIA director echoed news reports that Mubarak would announce his resignation.
I got the same information you did, that there is a strong likelihood that Mubarak may step down this evening.
So late into the night, the crowd in Tahrir Square was already celebrating moments before President Mubarak made that speech to the nation. But afterwards, they were stunned. Mubarak told them that he would transfer constitutional powers to his hand-picked vice president, Omar Suleiman. But he did not say he was leaving yet. Tahrir Square answered him in a furious roar. No, leave, leave, they shouted.
Go, Ahmed, go,
we're all here, Anthony, go!
Yet again, the mood had changed. Uncertainty reigned.
If not tomorrow morning early, it to be announced that he is out and the country is clean from him, it, no one can imagine and no one can say what could happen in this country.
But the people stayed peaceful, as they had throughout this, filing back into the square Friday morning, streaming past the tanks, making their way into Tahrir. And it was there that they heard the news that they had been waiting for, that changed everything once again. In a terse message lasting less than 1 minute, Vice President Suleiman came on state television to tell them that the president had stepped down and handed over control to the military. Egypt is free, they cried.
We've been here every single day, and today we brought our son to see this historic moment. He will read about this in books when he grows up.
History was being made as the world watched.
The word Tahrir means liberation. It is a word that speaks to that something in our souls that cries out for freedom. And forevermore, it will remind us of the Egyptian people, of what they did, of the things that they stood for, and how they changed their country, and in doing so, changed the world.
Today, it's clear that the Egyptian people have changed their world and also themselves. But what that change will look like inside their country and across the Arab world remains an unanswered question.
And my colleague, ABC Nightline anchor Terry Moran, has been there all this last week, including Friday when the revolution was won by the people. And he joins us now from Cairo. Terry, what is the latest?
Well, Christiane, the latest is that the government, in the form of military police, are starting slowly but with very determined effort to clear that square. They got some traffic running through the square now. They're trying to get the remaining protesters out. And there is a division in that square and in the country right now on how much to trust the military government and how much staying as protesters in the streets in that square will be a guarantee of change here. What you see in the square, we were just out there a little while ago, are really two groups. There's a hardcore group of protesters who say we aren't going to leave until we see that real change. But there are other groups chanting, it's time to go home. It's time to go home. It's not really that tense. There's a little pushing and shoving, but it represents the division that is growing in this country on what comes next, on what the post-Tahrir moment looks like.
Exactly, and we're going to be watching for that. So, Terry, thank you so much. And back... Terry Moran in Cairo and back here in Washington, as the Obama administration was keeping a close eye on the revolution in Egypt, the American Conservative Union held its annual CPAC conference. Potential Republican presidential contenders were critical of the president's foreign policy. One of them, Newt Gingrich, a man who led a revolution of his own in 1994 when Republicans took control of Congress, joins us now. He is a Fox News contributor and co-author, along with his wife, Calista, of a new book on Ronald Reagan called Rendezvous with Destiny. Thank you for being with us.
Good to be with you.
First of all, you did criticize President Obama's handling of this crisis in Egypt, and you called it timid, confused, and amazingly amateurish.
Well, let me just give you one example. When you appoint a very senior diplomat to be your special ambassador, he makes a statement in Munich about what we're doing, and 3 hours later, the White House is directly contradicting him.
What would you have done? What would you have done specifically in the big picture questions of you have an ally for 30 years, and then you have people power on the streets?
Look, I had lunch with George Shultz, who was Ronald Reagan's Secretary of State, at the Reagan Library for the 100th birthday last Sunday. Secretary Shultz said, when you have a situation like this, where you've had an ally for 30 years, you stay relatively quiet publicly, and you say to him privately, the time has come for you to leave. We are prepared to do what it takes to get you to leave. We'll find a way to, for you to leave with safety for you and your family. But this is over. But he said, you do it quietly because every other potential ally in the world is watching you. And if they see you publicly abandon somebody who's been with you for 30 years, they wonder, why should I trust the United States? But Schultz was quite clear, just as we had in Poland and in Czechoslovakia and in Hungary, we were, you know, the Reagan administration was adamantly in favor of freedom. And I think that he said we, and I think you have to start with the fact that it's the courage of the Egyptian people that made this possible, and we should be reinforcing and strengthening that courage.
Let me roll some tape of you with President Mubarak when you were House Speaker in 1994, and just look at what you said there.
Let me just say that we're very, very glad to have President Mubarak here. He is a very, very important ally, friend, and advisor, and many things that we've done, including Desert Shield, would not have been possible without the help of Egypt.
So again, very close ally, and yet you're also full-throated in the defense of democracy.
You know, it's the challenge that George W. Bush made in his second inaugural address, which is very complicated. He's saying, on the one hand, we are for democracy everywhere, and I think we have to be. That's the American mission in the world. It's why American exceptionalism is ultimately human exceptionalism, because everybody on the planet's endowed by their creator, including, by the way, Chinese, Russian, Iranian, Saudi. I mean, there are a lot of Venezuelan, Cuban. I mean, there are a lot of
so
places.
So the President Obama standing clearly for the protesters
is
by the
right
end
thing
of the,
to
is
do.
The right thing to
but
do.
But remember, this is an administration which, for reasons I don't understand, actually cut out the Democracy in Egypt funds inside the State Department.
Okay, so, well, as you know.
I don't think our focus shouldn't be on Obama. Our focus ought to be, what can America do now to make sure the military doesn't impose a new dictatorship for another 30 or 40 years? And how do we, on the other hand, make sure that you don't end up with a Muslim Brotherhood staging a coup at some point over a 3 or 4 or 5 year period?
Okay, so let me ask you, what does the U.S. do now to make sure that the military, which has put out no timeline, neither for lifting the emergency nor a roadmap for democracy, what does the United States, with such close relationships militarily, do right now?
I think we have to quietly, one of the great virtues of our military training program is we have a lot of senior officers who were in school with a lot of Egyptian officers. I think they need to be collectively calling their friends and saying, look, you don't want to own the country, because then you own every problem and you can't solve them. What you want to do, you don't want to become Burma. I mean, what you want to do is figure out a way to have a transition to a stable civilian government, recognize that over a fairly long period of time, the military is going to have less role in the economy, because right now, the military is a big part of the Egyptian economy.
And if they don't, do you use the very powerful lever of $1.5 billion
sure.
a year to the military?
Of course.
You pull it?
Yeah. You communicate. You may pull part of it. It may suddenly get a lot slower. You may not approve certain kind of activities. But we shouldn't kid ourselves. I mean, Egypt has been a staging area for us for a long time now. And Egypt has been vital to Israeli security. And so I think I think we should be pressuring everywhere, and I want to repeat, including China, including Russia, including Cuba. We should be pushing steadily and saying, you know, America stands for freedom.
You talked about the Muslim Brotherhood, and clearly many people are worried about the future. Now, they've made statements that they're not interested in the presidential position right now. You said, under no circumstances should the United States be willing to support a government in Egypt that lifts this ban against the Muslim Brotherhood. Well, already the Egyptian authorities have de facto, because they've been talking to them. So, under no circumstances,
well,
what does that mean?
I think we should try every way we can to ensure the two things the Muslim Brotherhood will ultimately want are the Interior Ministry and education.
But they haven't said that.
No, but I'm just saying, if you watch them with Hamas, if you watch them everywhere in the region, they understand that if they can get control of the schools, they're very patient. They have a 20 or 30 year strategy. This is not an overnight group.
So let me ask you, the logical denouement of democracy is that they may elect people who you don't like. You're not able to control democracy. So how do you thread that needle?
This is a huge challenge. It's not a question of liking or disliking. I mean, I'm perfect. We have lots of governments.
No, but still, how do you try to control democracy?
Every society has to come to grips with the fact that there are some elements who would create a dictatorship. So you'd have one last vote. It wouldn't be a democracy. It'd be one last vote. And whether it is Lenin replacing Kerensky, whether it is Hitler taking over in Germany, whether it is the Ayatollah running Iran, you have to be very cautious about the idea that that you can automatically accept a group if, in fact, you have pretty good reason to believe that their goal is a dictatorship. It's the tragedy of Zimbabwe, where you have a government which clearly is totally illegitimate.
Very quickly, one of the levers that America does have is democracy building, but that requires foreign aid.
Yes.
And that's often one of the first things that's cut. Do you think foreign aid in this regard should be bolstered?
Well, first of all, I think you ought to look at how much we're already spending and look at
how much do you think?
We spend, including aid for health and things, we spend something like $35 or $40 billion.
It's 1% of the U.S. budget. But my question is, if you really want democracy, would you favor increasing aid to that?
And my answer is, I'd first want to look at how we currently spend the aid. I don't think our bureaucracy giving money to their bureaucracy is democracy.
No, to NGOs
I would certainly look at rethinking the current foreign aid program and shifting a great deal more out of government bureaucracies into NGOs and, frankly, into investments. I think the tax credit for countries that are very poor, I supported the Africa Free Trade Bill for that reason.
And to get back to your future after CPAC, when will you make your decision? Are you going to run for president?
Well, close to now, I'll probably make a decision by the end of this month about whether or not to set up an exploratory committee, and we're working our way through it.
So no decision right now to tell us?
Not this morning.
No?
No.
Thank you very much.
Glad to be here.
With the military now in charge of Egypt, what steps are being taken to ensure a transition to democracy? Joining me now is Egypt's ambassador to the United States, Samer Shoukry, a friend of the program, trying to explain what is happening in Egypt. First and foremost, who is in charge? Yes, the military, but is Vice President Soleiman still there? Is Prime Minister Ahmed Shafiq?
The Supreme Military Council is chaired by the Minister of Defense, Field Marshal Tantawi, so he would be in charge collectively with the council. The council has decided to maintain the current government of Prime Minister Ahmed Shafiq as a caretaker government to be changed at a later stage.
So the military now and also Prime Minister Shafiq's latest communique is that the prime aim is to restore security. But that seems to be a little bit of odds with what the protests are saying, many wanting to stay there until their democratic aspirations are met or at least outlined.
Certainly there's a security void it's necessary to restructure the police force, but also the economic conditions must be addressed as well. So the first priority are security and the economic welfare, but that doesn't preclude that the reform process would not go ahead as well.
Well then, tell me exactly what we expect. When will the emergency law be lifted?
In accordance with the fourth communique of the Supreme Military Council, it would be lifted as soon as the current conditions of protest have been terminated.
But when? Next week? Next year?
They haven't defined yet a specific timetable. I believe that they will do so as conditions stabilize.
So that also uncertain, that a key demand of the U.S. and of the protesters. What about a clear roadmap to elections? Will elections happen in September, as President Mubarak had been saying?
Well, yesterday, the field marshal had meetings with the Minister of Justice and with the Chief of the Supreme Court in an effort to start to formulate the legislative and constitutional reforms that are necessary to hold free and fair elections.
Do you think that's in a matter of months for elections or a year or so?
There are conflicting opinions within the opposition and the government related to the time span that might be needed.
Could it be a year?
I've heard some in the opposition speaking about the necessity of a year so as to establish the political environment, so as the parties will be able to present their platforms and field their candidates.
Without the current, without President Mubarak as the ally, very pro-Western, pro-United States, had that close relationship with Israel, do you think a new system in Egypt will be as automatically favorable to doing what the U.S. wants, what Israel wants, as the previous one?
I think the government of Egypt does what is in its best interest and that of its people. And these issues are institutional issues. The relationship, U.S.-Egyptian relationship, is a deep one.
Can the U.S. count on the same kind of support as it had before?
Certainly. These issues are driven by mutual interest, by Egyptian interests, and interest remains a close association to the United States.
Where is President Mubarak?
I have no immediate knowledge of his whereabouts.
Is he in Sharm el-Sheikh?
I believe he is in Egypt. I have no information related to specifically where he might be.
But in Egypt?
That's my understanding.
A lot of concern about Israel's international treaties. Yes, the Egyptian military said it would honor the treaties, but people are still worried. Do you believe in the future the peace treaty with Israel will stand?
I do believe so. The treaty has been beneficial to Egypt over the last 30 years or more. We have derived a peace dividend from the treaty. We've been able to establish security and stability in the region, and I believe it is a main element in terms of our foreign policy.
Ambassador Shukri, thank you for joining us. The popular uprising in Egypt has sent tremors throughout the Middle East. This weekend in Algeria, thousands of demonstrators took to the streets, defying a government ban on protests. In Libya and Iran, protesters have vowed to follow suit. And on the Arabian Peninsula, there have been more demonstrations in Yemen, a close U.S. ally, where U.S. officials believe that al-Qaeda operatives pose one of the greatest risks. ABC's senior foreign affairs correspondent Martha Raddatz has sent this report from Yemen.
Friday night, Yemen's capital erupted in joy at the news that President Mubarak had stepped down. But as exuberant as these demonstrators were, this ended only an hour later. On Saturday, they gathered again, this time with some violent clashes. But the anti-government protesters had already gotten much of what they wanted. Weeks ago, in an unprecedented show of strength, tens of thousands of demonstrators hit the streets of Yemen, forcing Yemen's authoritarian president, Ali Abdullah Saleh, who was carefully watching events in Egypt, into a preemptive strike. Saleh, who has ruled for more than three decades, promised he would not run for re-election in 2013. But there is another, more ominous reason these protests have not spread. Yemen is the poorest, least educated, and most fragile country in the Arab world. It is also heavily armed. And even opposition leaders seem genuinely afraid that if protests get out of control, the country could collapse.
They don't use weapons because they realize the results of using such weapons. There will be a catastrophe.
Which is a nightmare scenario for the United States and other Western countries. Yemen has become a major breeding ground for al-Qaeda. Its remote villages and rugged terrain ideal for militant cells to hide and train. The failed Christmas Day bomber who hid explosives in his underwear in 2009 trained here. Last October, bombs disguised as toner cartridges placed on U.S.-bound cargo planes were mailed from Yemen. And hiding somewhere in this country's southern provinces, the American-born radical cleric Anwar al-Awlaki, thought to have also inspired the attacks at Fort Hood and the Times Square bomber.
I think both in the US and the UK and many other countries, we regard al-Qaeda in Yemen and now as way up there in the top level of threats.
In the last 5 years, the US has given Yemen more than $250 million in aid, the majority going to the military. General Yahya Saleh, nephew of Yemen's president, is in charge of the country's security forces, including the 250 U.S.-trained counterterrorism troops.
If you had to say how many al-Qaeda inner circle there are, what would you say?
Hundreds.
Hundreds?
Al-Qaeda is indeed stronger than ever. The Yemenis are cooperating, but there is no strong intelligence network here. Drones and other surveillance equipment are hunting, but in the remote provinces where al-Awlaki and the other al-Qaeda members are hiding, the local tribes are protecting them. And there is no way the U.S. is sending ground forces in. That would make matters worse.
Yeah, Yemeni people, they are against any troops or any president of the United States or from any countries. Because al-Qaeda will use it against the government, against our cooperation, and will recruit more people.
U.S. missile strikes last May that accidentally killed civilians exacerbated that and angered the Yemeni government. But the U.S. and Yemen remain allies in this fight to get rid of al-Qaeda, a fight that will undoubtedly take a lot more time and a lot more money.
But U.S. officials know they can't push the Yemeni government too hard because without its help, the situation here could get much worse. Christiane?
Martha Raddatz in Yemen. And today there is news out of Egypt that in the last few minutes, a new military communique has said that the military will dissolve parliament, a key demand of the protesters, and also that they will be in power at least for 6 months until elections can be organized. Now, also, just a day after Mubarak was toppled, the military government, as we've reported, pledged that its peace treaty with Israel would be honored. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu welcomed the statement, calling the treaty the cornerstone for peace and stability in the Middle East. But there's also great concern in Israel over what or who will replace Mubarak. Earlier this week, I spoke exclusively with Israel's Defense Minister Ehud Barak.
When you look at what's happening in Egypt and you make your analysis, do you think that Egypt is headed towards an Iranian-style revolution or to an Egyptian nationalistic revolution?
I don't believe that something similar to the Iranian events 30 years ago is happening now. I think that the Egyptians, they have their own way. I think that the direction is something which emerges very genuinely and in a spontaneous manner. It was not something that was organized by extremist groups of Muslim radical origins, and I think that we should respect their intention and need. I think that they have to listen to voices from the rest of the world.
Israel has been dealing with President Mubarak for the last at least 30 years. What do you fear or what are you concerned about as you see this longtime ally of yours stepping out of power?
You know, I first of all want to state that I don't think the relationship between Israel and Egypt is under any risk, or that any kind of operational risk is waiting us just behind the corner.
But with the crowds on Tahrir Square calling for immediate results, Defense Minister Barak does say that he's concerned about a rush to elections.
The real winners of any short-term election, let's say within 90 days, will be the Muslim Brotherhood, because they are already ready to jump. And the usually in revolutions, if they are violent, there is an eruption of idealist sentiments at the first moment, and later on, sooner than later, the only group which is coherent, focused, ready to kill and be killed if necessary, takes power. That should be avoided in Egypt, because that could be a catastrophe for the whole region.
You speak very strongly about your fears about the Muslim Brotherhood. They have written an op-ed in the New York Times. They told me personally, and anybody who will listen, that A, they're not leading this revolution, it's the young people who are doing it.
That's true.
That's true.
Yeah.
And B, they don't want to run for president, they don't want to have any ministerial positions. They want, they say, a civil democratic state for the future. Do you believe them?
I tend not to believe radical Muslim movements, but I should admit that they did not, to the best of my understanding, they did not initiate it, or were not originally behind it, but they are always deployed to take advantage of it. And I think that we should not very easily compare them to the most extremist groups of terror and so on. It's a Egyptian version. Many of them are less extremist.
The Obama administration is wrong on terrorism, wrong on Iran, wrong on the Muslim Brotherhood, wrong on Hezbollah. And being wrong on that many national security items is an enormously dangerous thing.
It is my sincere hope that at some point in the near future, this president will finally be able to construct a foreign policy, any foreign policy.
Mr. President, stop apologizing for our country.
That was former Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty and some of the other Republicans who are weighing a White House bid, lashing out at the Obama administration's foreign policy at the annual Conservative Political Action Conference in Washington. As the conference was ending, I spoke with Governor Pawlenty and I began by asking him whether he had confidence that Egypt's military will make free democratic elections there.
Well, we sure hope so. They are certainly one of the highest functioning institutions in that country, and now we need to see if the trust and confidence that people have in them holds true.
What should the United States military, the Defense Secretary of the U.S., the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, be saying to the Egyptian military right now?
Well, they should be saying the first step that we need is to make sure the rules are clear and fair and permanent and reliable, and that's why pushing those constitutional changes is so important. Now, the Egyptian military, as you know, is mostly equipped with American equipment and technology and training. They like it. That seems to be something the military there values. So ensuring and guaranteeing or at least offering the continuation of that kind of relationship is one lever, one apple or one carrot to hang out.
And pulling it is one stick?
Yes, but keep in mind, if you pull it, I'm sure some other countries will be willing to fill the void. And then we lose leverage in that scenario. So this is a very delicate situation.
And what is better for the United States and for the region? We've been hearing for 30 years that Mubarak was the stable ally, the recipient of all this aid and all this attention. Is that the stability that the U.S. can count on, or is it representative democracy no matter who's elected?
Well, I think history shows that authoritarian regimes offer only a false stability. And so you could see, I think, and will see in other places around the world, a frustration that builds within the people when they're suppressed, when they're oppressed, and when they're forced to live under authoritarian regimes.
What should the United States do in these situations?
There are non-governmental organizations here and internationally that could have been incrementally building democratic capacity and reasonable alternatives, not just in a crisis, but over the last 3, 5, 10 years. And let me give you one example. This administration, the Obama administration, proposed and the Congress enacted a cut to the institutions that build democracy in Egypt of 50% over the last 2 years. Now, that wasn't a good decision.
No matter whether you or anybody likes it, what if democracy there does produce a Muslim Brotherhood dominated first round of a new government? My question really is, how can you have democracy and also try to control it?
Well, we have to make sure we put these things in proper order. One is our interests from a national security standpoint are trying to avoid having a radical Islamic regime in charge of a country like Egypt, and also Egypt in particular. When President Obama was asked the other night by one of your competitors on another network, directly in an interview right before the Super Bowl, do you think the Muslim Brotherhood should be running Egypt? He wouldn't answer the question. They asked him 2 or 3 times, and the President of the United States ducked the question whether he thought it was a good or a bad idea whether the Muslim Brotherhood should be running Egypt. I'm telling you, it's a bad idea, and we need to do whatever we can to minimize the likelihood of that outcome.
What should President Obama have said to the protesters? What would you have done in the very first instance when all of this started?
Well, first of all, before his administration spoke like a Tower of Babel with multiple voices saying multiple things, they should have had one message that was clear and consistent and measured and appropriate. Instead, you had the president, the vice president, the secretary of state, the national intelligence director going off in different directions saying nearly incoherent things, at least inconsistent things. It's really important the United States of America speak with one voice. So first of all, get your own team on the same page. That's lesson number one in a crisis.
You know, you talk about a radical result, and a lot of people are very afraid of that possibility. The defense minister of Israel, Ehud Barak, told me that he did not see what happened in Iran 30 years ago happening in Egypt. If that's good enough for him, is it good enough for you?
Well, we don't know what the future of Egypt is going to yield at this point. So anybody who says they know what's going to happen in Egypt 10 years from now or 20 years from now, and that's good enough for them, I would say it would be good for everybody to step back and wait and see, because the proof's going to be in the pudding.
I want to push you on this issue of sending democracy-building institutions to these countries. The only way to do that is through the foreign aid budget. Would you as so many do, slash that budget, or would you increase it for precisely the reasons that you say it should be done?
Well, I would do a number of things with it. First of all, I would, when we look at our budget crisis in the United States, most things are going to have to be reduced somewhat. But I'm not one that says we should eliminate foreign aid. I don't think that is a wise course.
Governor Pawlenty, on that note, thank you very much indeed for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Our assessment is that the Egyptian government is stable.
Mubarak has been an ally of ours. I would not refer to him as a dictator.
An orderly transition must be meaningful, it must be peaceful, and it must begin now.
Now started yesterday.
The people of Egypt have spoken, their voices have been heard, and Egypt will never be the same.
Welcome back. Some of the statements made by the Obama administration as it tried to keep up with events in Egypt. We're joined now on our roundtable by George Will, Arianna Huffington, Robert Kagan of the Brookings Institution, and the Egyptian journalist Mona El-Tahawi. Thank you all for being here. What an amazing week. George, to you first. You've heard on this program and at CPAC the fierce criticisms of President Obama by the Republicans on how this was handled. Fair play?
Not fair. Conservatives have a kind of bifurcated mind. They say at home, rightly, the government exaggerates its competence, its ability to manage a complex society. Then overseas, they fault the government for not fine-tuning an extraordinarily fluid event. The administration has not gotten ahead of events because no one knows where the events are heading. Right now, we're in the second inning of a nine-inning game. We have, on the government side, Bonapartism without a Bonaparte, which is a good thing. The last thing you want is a Bonaparte. On the protesters' side, you have no Lech Walesa, no Vaclav Havel, extraordinary unled spontaneousness about this. And that means there's obviously continuing danger. 1952, Nasser comes to power. 1954, millions of Egyptians go into the streets saying, we don't like what looks like a military regime. Nasser says, not to worry, we're going to have elections. Protesters get arrested, and a military dictatorship is screwed down on the country.
And Mona, precisely, there's been military rule since 1952, and as George says, no one of those great inspirational leaders from the Eastern European revolutions. What do you think is the next move?
I think the opposition is talking, and I think the opposition is coming up with this organic leadership that is what makes this revolution so beautiful. But I think what will help them, Christian, is ending the cynicism that exists everywhere in D.C. I mean, I'm appalled as an Egyptian living through the most historic time of my life that, first of all, with Tunisia, no one thought Tunisia could do it. And then they said no one but Tunisia could do it. Then it started in Egypt and said, no, no, it's not going to work. And then it worked in Egypt. And now they're saying, no, no, they're not going to pull it off. The Muslim Brotherhood, the army, and nowhere else in the region is this going to happen. So I'm here in D.C. thinking, you know what? I want to bring that freedom rally that is sweeping across the region to D.C. so that people here can start believing that people power counts, you know, and that will help people in Egypt.
Will it happen in the domino theory, Bob?
I think we're seeing unquestionably a new moment in the Arab world, and that there's ferment. All these old corrupt dictatorships which have been, you know, clamping down on their people for decades and which we have supported in the interest of stability, I think that those days are over. And now, although I agree with George, it's very hard to fine-tune these things, but there is a sense of getting ahead of the curve and at least being where history is going. And I think it's very important the United States do that.
How?
Now. Well, I think we do have to do what we didn't do in Egypt over the past couple of years, which is press for gradual reforms so that you don't wind up creating a tinderbox that explodes. There are reforms that can be undertaken in Jordan. There are reforms that can be undertaken in Algeria and elsewhere. It's not going to be easy, but you do have to start pressing in that direction.
Mm-hmm. And actually, in a very prescient article, Bob said that just before the uprising started, we've been looking the other way in country after country in the Middle East, and this is the time to actually demand some gradual but real reforms. But right now, Christian, there's been a perfect storm of three conditions. You know, the growing connectivity in the Middle East, you know, phenomenal what is happening, you know, 5 million people on Facebook in Egypt. There's been the growing unemployment among the young, which has been a tinderbox, especially after the global recession. And also there's been this real organization of a dozen to 15 real leaders, including Ghanim from Google, who've been doing a lot of very creative and very important things. And so even though there isn't a Lech Walesa, there is real leadership behind this movement.
Right, but let me ask about the sort of perhaps what was so last century, the foreign policy stability paradigm was about authoritarian leaders thinking that it was stable. In 18 days, that stability just collapsed. So is stability, and should it be, faith in a democratic representative government, no matter who they are?
Well, it depends. I mean, I'm not sure any of us here would rejoice if Pakistan said it was going to have elections in 60 days. Who knows who would win? You have to have some idea of the outcome of freedom before you can endorse freedom. But all modern tyrannies have depended on intellectual autarky, being able to seal off the consciousness of their people from the outside world, and that's the connectivity that you're talking about. Can't be done anymore. And it may be the case, then, that tyranny is just not feasible anymore, in which case the old theory of the Arab exception, that somehow the Arabs are exceptionally immune to the democratic wave, has to be rethought.
Absolutely.
You know what's changed also, Christian, and this ties it into social media and people like Wael Ghanem. Since social media started spreading across the Arab world, and you had a generation that has always been marginalized and told, you do not count, everyone started realizing, I count. That is an incredible force, I count, against this dictator who always told you, I am the country, and I count. So I think what we heard from President Obama's speech, you know, this kind of this moment of clarity, was his understanding that stability does lie with the people and the people counting, rather than a dictator and what he used to promise.
And as George said, you have to know what freedom is before you can endorse it. Is that realistic?
Well, again, you can't say, unless we have 100% guarantee that we're going to get exactly the outcome we want in an election, I don't think George is saying that, then we can't support an election. You know, we have made the mistake of thinking that dictators were our friends in this struggle. But even in Pakistan, the generals who controlled Pakistan, Zia and Musharraf, Islamic radicalism flourished under them, in fact, almost as a conscious tactic, and Mubarak the same. Mm-hmm. And so we've been under the illusion that these dictators were somehow bulwarks against radicalism, and we need to understand that stability is not dictatorship. Stability may mean a gradual change toward genuine democratic society.
But also many powers, are sort of, including Iran, are under the illusion that they can control what's happening. You know, whether we endorse it or not may be irrelevant. Whether Iran calls for an Islamic revolution as it did or not is irrelevant, because this is not an Islamic revolution. You know, there are Christians and Muslims, and it has a real non-ideological tenor, which is what makes it so strong.
Well, let me actually ask you to elaborate on that, because clearly everybody is terrified that what's going to happen in Egypt is another Iran. Is that a real fear today?
No, you know, Egypt is not Iran, but more simply, the Muslim Brotherhood represent maybe 20% of Egyptians. If you were to ask me what ideal government would take over in Egypt, I would like, or would be elected, no more takeover, would be elected in Egypt. For sure the Muslim Brotherhood would be represented, as they should, but it would be so many other Egyptians. Now, you remember when you spoke to Hosni Mubarak last week, Christian, he told you, Egyptians don't understand, you don't understand our culture. And Suleiman told you, Egyptians don't understand democracy. Look at what an insulting approach they had to their own people. People in the streets of Egypt told them, we do understand democracy and we're ready for it. In that democracy is the Muslim Brotherhood, but they will not take over.
Bob, isn't one of the ways to encourage democracy in a sort of an orderly fashion, if you like, the U.S. has that ability through its NGOs, it hasn't done it, particularly under this administration.
Well, unfortunately, when the administration came to office, the mantra of foreign policy was, whatever Bush did, we're not doing. So Bush had aid going into democracy organizations, NGOs in Egypt, and the first thing the Obama administration did, unfortunately, was cut that off. I think that our aid now needs to be channeled precisely to make up for the deficiencies that Mubarak created, to help secular political parties, to help liberal political parties organize and put themselves on a level where they can compete evenly with the Muslim Brotherhood, which is the only group that Mubarak did allow to organize. And yes, the United States does have an important role in doing this.
And we have this leverage of the $2 billion that we give Egypt every year. Of course, let's compare that to the $2.8 billion that we spend on Afghanistan every week, just to see how we also need to refigure our priorities in the globe.
Mm-hmm. Well, what we want to do is help them get where we got, where multi-party countries, In 1789, we ratified the Constitution. Everyone was agreed we shouldn't have political parties. They were bad things. Instantly fell to creating political parties because they're absolutely essential. The question is, how fast can this spontaneous combustion become institution building? And we're pretty good at that. We know how to do
that. So helping through the foreign aid budget, I mean, really using that strategically.
The National Endowment for Democracy. There are all kinds of people in this town who spend their entire lives thinking about this. Tap what they know.
A lot of institutions that Ronald Reagan set up during what is now known as the great wave of democracy, democratization that occurred in the late 70s and then on through the 80s.
So hopefully that won't be slashed in this deficit busting mania.
It would be foolish. It would be the most foolish strategic decision we could make.
It's a rounding error on the General Motors bailout.
It's important to remember we have a history of political parties, Christian, because before 1952, we had many problems in Egypt, especially the poverty gap, but we had a vibrant parliamentary democracy of sorts, despite British occupation and the monarchy. We had political parties, we had prime ministers that would come and go, Muslim and Christian. We have that history in Egypt. We need to revive that history and make it more equitable.
And a very good note on which to stop and to continue this discussion in the green room at abcnews.com/thisweek, where you can also find our fact checks in conjunction with PolitiFact. And after this incredible week, many have said what happened in Egypt is really a body blow against the Al-Qaeda ideology. The last time people were cheering in the streets of the Arab world was after 9/11 for the very wrong reasons, and now we see them cheering for the right reasons, for freedom and democracy. A shift indeed. Thanks for being with us. Stay with ABC News and across ABC for all the latest on Egypt. See you next week.